Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on July 17, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the healthcare decision. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. So now that the healthcare decision has some age, we've invited back Professor Randy Barnett to give us his considered opinion on the outcome of the case, some of its practical implications, and its meaning for the Supreme Court jurisprudence going forward. Professor Barnett's going to speak for some 10 minutes, and he'll take questions from you, the callers. So with that, Professor Barnett, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks for having me back again, which for what I assume will be the last teleforum on the Affordable Care Act challenge. I'm certainly ready to get back to my summer research and away from this case, but I'm delighted to talk about it one more time because there's an awful lot that's been said about this case, especially by people on the right, that I think somewhat misconstrue what happened and what its significance is. So let me begin by admitting that I was very disappointed in the outcome, that in fact I felt like I was sort of kicked in the gut, and I still feel that way. So I'm not walking around, you know, whistling happily about what we accomplished in this case. But we did accomplish quite a bit, and I think it's really wrong for conservatives and libertarians to become so doom and gloom, which also tends to be sort of our natural tendency sometimes. That we are willing to, we want to sort of paint the picture so black that we give up all that we gained. So let me just talk a little bit about what we gained, and then I'll talk a little bit about what we lost. What we were trying to do was knock out Obamacare, and clearly we didn't succeed in doing that. On the other hand, knocking out the entire law was always a very long shot. It would have required, all we had to go after was the mandate and the Medicaid provisions. And then we had to somehow knock out the rest of the bill by having it not be severed. That was always a very tough, a very tall hill to climb. What we succeeded in doing was we weakened the mandate. It is no longer a mandate. Justice Roberts, in the least appreciated part of his opinion, I think, eliminated the requirement that people buy insurance, which was the mandate, and left only the penalty, which he then recharacterized as a tax. He let the penalty stand, but it's no longer the case that all Americans have to buy insurance. We've established the proposition that that's unconstitutional under both the tax power and both the commerce power and the tax power. What's left is a mandate. I mean, what's left is a penalty called a tax, and that tax can only be a reasonable tax. It was upheld because it was a small amount, less than the cost of compliance with the wish that we get insurance. And that's the reason why that it was upheld. So the mandate is weakened. The CBO assumptions that were based on the fact that people would feel obligated to adhere to the law, that assumption has to be revised. And in fact, I think the CBO estimate of what the cost of Obamacare is going to be is going to have to be revised as a result of that. And so the already weak mandate is even weaker than it was, which I think is going to undermine the viability of the entire scheme. The insurance companies were never happy with the weakness of the penalty as it stood in the law. They're going to be less happy with this, and I think they're going to be more inclined to look for a repeal or replace when the time comes for that to happen. Secondly, we were able, by means of this lawsuit, to hold up the legitimacy of this law for over 10 years. Admittedly, we had another thing going for us, and that is that the implementation of the law was in large measure delayed to 2014. But we also were able to dirty up the law and add to the policy objections to it the problematic constitutionality of the law, which made it possible for the Republicans to take control of the Congress in 2010 on a platform of repeal, and for there to be a presidential election on the platform of repeal 2.5 years into the tenure of this law, which is something that is really remarkable and something that the lawsuit contributed importantly to. So that's on the Obamacare side what we accomplished. On the legal side, we got pretty much everything we asked for. That's what was so astonishing about the outcome. The five justices of the Supreme Court, including Chief Justice Roberts, adopted every argument we made about the limitations of the commerce power and that it was unconstitutional for Congress to mandate economic activity in order to regulate it under the commerce power. It accepted every argument we made about the necessary and proper clause not being a power to allow Congress to do an end run around the enumerated power scheme, and specifically held that the means that was chosen here, that is of an economic mandate, was an improper means under the Necessary and Proper Clause. We had very little law on our side on the Necessary and Proper Clause argument. Just two cases, Prince and New York about state commandeering, were all we had. We now have a very powerful case that there is such a, that it, the criteria of propriety is in addition to the criteria of necessity under the Necessary and Proper Clause. This case stands for that proposition in a telling fashion. So that's two major things. We accomplished for the first time since the New Deal a restraint on the spending power. The courts have not previously, since the New Deal, found any spending act of the spending power unconstitutional as beyond Congress's power. In this case, the court did. It held that Congress did not have the power to withhold existing Medicaid funding as a way of extracting an agreement to an additional huge expansion of the Medicaid program. That's the first time that's ever happened. That's major new, good, positive directions in the spending power. So now that brings me, so those are all really important going forward. And also as important, before I get to the one bad thing, which is the tax power, obviously, is the fact that it could have been so much worse. Think about where we would have been in, what the position we would have been in if the government's argument had been accepted and or the position of the four liberals had been accepted. At that point, what we would have under the commerce power and necessary and proper clause power would be a national problems clause that would allow Congress to regulate any problem that it deemed to be national in scope that had or had something to do with the nation's economy. That was what we were fighting to prevent from happening. That was the rationale that everyone was arguing was necessary to uphold the mandate, and we defeated that rationale. We have preserved the enumerated power scheme to live to fight another day, assuming we have a court that's willing to do that, which, of course, is a big assumption. So that's huge. That's just absolutely major. Now let me get to the final point, which is the obvious bad law that was made with respect to the taxing power. Let me reiterate what I said at the beginning. It is not true, it is not accurate to say that, as it was immediately said in the aftermath of this case, that Congress is now Congress has a power to impose economic mandates on the people, provided they do it under the taxing power. That's not what Chief Justice Roberts said. What he said was that a requirement was unconstitutional, the mandate was unconstitutional under any power, and he had to rewrite the statute to eliminate the requirement, give it a savings construction that would then uphold only the penalty, deem the penalty a tax, and then say the tax was constitutional. Now, that was still bad law, because a tax of this sort is either a direct tax that was not apportioned, or I should say it was a direct tax that was not apportioned, and it was also a tax on inactivity, which is something that was also unprecedented. But if a justice was absolutely motivated to uphold this law, Chief Justice Roberts, who obviously had that motivation, did it in the least damaging way to what we stand for. And I'm sure he did that knowingly, because that was the part of the deal he gave us in return for giving the president and the Democrats the law that they wanted so badly to be upheld. So that was the bad part. One last thought experiment before I open this up for questions. When you want to think about what things might have been, imagine that Congress had drafted the law exactly the way they did, only they called the penalty a tax. Now, not even the rewritten law that Chief Justice Roberts upheld with no mandate, but they had the mandate in there too, and they called the penalty a tax. I think it's pretty safe to predict that even though the law would have been on our side, chances are, I think it's very unlikely that any lower court would have found that that explicit exercise of the tax power was beyond Congress's power. And I don't think any court of appeals would have, and I doubt the Supreme Court would have granted cert to take this case. We would have been looking at a great expansion of the tax power under that scenario, and no good law under the Commerce Clause, no good law being made under the Necessary and Proper Clause, and very likely no good law made on the spending power. We would be way behind where we are today if Congress had simply written the bill and used the word tax. And we certainly would not have prevailed if Congress had written the bill the way Chief Justice Roberts rewrote the bill. So we are way ahead of where we were if in two respects. One is if the arguments that had been made by the other side were accepted by the court, they were actually rejected, they only commanded four votes. And secondly, if Congress had actually done this a different way, we would not be where we are today, and the Affordable Care Act would probably be sailing along as enacted law. So with that, I'm prepared to take any questions people may have.
Terrific. Thank you, Professor. We've got about 220 people on the phone. I do want to get to their questions, see what's on their minds. I'm going to open the floor to questions from the audience and tell you by looking at my computer screen, Randy, the interest in this case has not dissipated. So we've got, it looks like we'll start with about 10 questions, and we'll try and get through as many of these as possible. Well, let's go to the first question.
Do I understand correctly that tax legislation must originate in the House? If so, where did the Obamacare legislation originate, and did the Chief Justice's opinion address that issue at all?
Well, for a very long time, Congress has gotten around the origination clause, which says that all tax legislation must originate in the House, by the Senate taking a bill that did originate in the House, amending that bill by striking every word inside of it and replacing it in toto with a different bill, and that's how this bill was deemed to have been originated in the House. It is a fiction. It's a pernicious fiction. It's another part of what I call the lost Constitution, because the courts won't enforce this provision of the Constitution under what's known as the enrolled bill doctrine, which dates back to 1792, even though that really had nothing to do with this particular practice. It was something like that, where it said Congress won't question whether, when a bill is enrolled, whether it was properly enacted or not. At any rate, because of this pernicious fiction, the important constraint on Congress's power has been undermined by Congress, and the courts have not stepped in to fix that. The Chief Justice Roberts did not address that, and the dissenters in their joint dissent made reference to the origination clause, but never mentioned the fact that you can comply with the clause without complying with it. So this is really something that we ought to put on our agenda for future justices who are constitutional conservatives to fix. And it's just not something that was done in this case.
Thank you.
Okay, next question.
Randy, hi. I just wanted to comment, not question. I think you're a hero. You're certainly a hero to me. You stuck to your guns in the face of the really condescending attitudes of the prominent liberal law professors who disagreed with you, and you won. So kudos to you, and I hope President Romney makes you the first appointment of the Supreme Court.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I'm sure that I won't be appointed to the Supreme Court, but it actually makes a difference to me to hear people say this, because obviously I feel very disappointed at the outcome. And I did learn in the Rage case an important lesson, which I've told people ever since, and that is you can't make a justice do what they don't want to do. And there were, Chief Justice Roberts had his own reasons for why he didn't want to rule. He didn't want to follow the law that we explained that he accepted, and that's on him. It's really not on us. So I very much appreciate your comments. They mean a lot to me.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to the next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's explore perhaps some of the worst outcomes that could result from the tax on inactivity precedent. I'm one who sees it more darkly that it may be a precedent as serious as Wickard, because now Congress may do things like it did with firearms, where they passed a tax on certain firearms, then created a penalty, they made it a crime to possess an item on which the tax had not been paid, then refused to allocate money to accept payment of the tax, but of course allocated and created a budget for prosecuting anyone who admitted that he was in violation by trying to pay the tax. There are lots of ways that a tax on inactivity can be hidden in all kinds of future legislation that can then be used to oppress us in ways that I think most members of the professoriate may not begin to appreciate. But as someone who's observed government with a somewhat paranoid mien, supported by abundant anecdotal evidence, I'm afraid that we need to consider this a very dangerous move.
Well, thanks, John, for your comment. I think the tax precedent is a bad precedent, and there's all kinds of nefarious things that – I mean, I already said that if Congress had passed this law as a tax and a mandate tax, I mean, exactly the same, I think the courts would have upheld it, and then we would have had even worse than we've got here. So that's just because the courts basically let Congress do what they want with respect to taxes in ways that you've described. That's all very bad. It's just that what would have been a Wickard case is if, I mean, only a Wickard on steroids case, is if the courts had said that Congress has the power under the Commerce and Necessary and Proper Clause to mandate that anybody engage in economic activity or they'll put you in jail if they don't, because under the Commerce power, they can put you in jail like they do. They put drug offenders in jail using the Commerce power. As if they put drug, if the drug laws were only enforced using the tax power described by Justice Roberts, then people would have to pay a reasonable fine, and they wouldn't be criminals. Remember, Chief Justice Roberts says you're not a criminal if you're not acting illegally if you don't buy insurance. You fully fulfilled your obligation as a citizen if you simply pay the fee. So if you paid the fee, then you could do the act. Now, having said that, everything about this case is going to be determined by our political future, our political culture. Whether this case is actually a good case or a bad case, or whether any case is a good case or a bad case, is going to depend on future justices. It is very important that we delegitimate that bad part of this case because of the way it was decided. It's very important that we be clear that that part of the case was politically motivated and therefore is not due the same kind of respect that other precedents normally get. The four dissenting justices certainly feel that way. I can't believe that liberals really respect this opinion as a legal decision, although they like the outcome. It's very important that that part of the case not be accepted, so the future justices, should they be inclined, can put the limits on this tax power idea that need to be put there. And whether they do that or not is going to depend on what president gets elected, what Senate gets elected, and who is nominated for the Supreme Court in the future. If we don't do well in the next election, and if more justices get appointed by the Democrats, and I hate to be partisan about this, but I think it's pretty obvious, a tax mandate is going to be the least of our worries in this country.
Yeah, however, the way the IRS works, if they have a claim, they can deduct it from whatever money is of yours is floating around, including anything paid to them as withholding, and then dun you not for the penalty, which is actually called a...
John, let me interrupt you right now. I don't think we're going to settle this between you and me today, and I think we should leave it open for other questions now.
Yeah, okay.
All right, looks like we might be headed to Michigan for our next question.
Hi, Professor Barnett. Steve Klein with Wyoming Liberty Group. Just wanted to touch on your thoughts on the Medicaid expansion decision out here in Wyoming and in smaller states. It seems like this is huge. It was a huge victory, and certainly it kind of flipped things on, you know, another kind of a thing that was very unexpected in this case, because when we were arguing, you know, the Commerce Clause, one of the strongest things was the government couldn't articulate really a limiting principle, and when we were arguing against Medicaid expansion, the limiting principle was, well, here it is, found it. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, obviously, that was one of the problems we had. We had a limiting principle problem on the Medicaid challenge part. Nobody gave us much of a shot to even have that claim accepted for cert. It lost below, but remember, it had lost in the district court, it lost in the 11th Circuit, and yet it was the petition for cert was accepted. I know that my friend Paul Clement, who was responsible for that part of the case, was quite surprised that cert was granted. And I think it's because of the political nature of John Roberts' decision that he gave us that part, along with the other part, because that allowed him to uphold the law to the extent that he did. So we benefited in that respect from the political nature of his decision. And again, it was a huge victory. It enabled state governors to further undermine this law. You've got the mandate being weakened. You've got Medicaid, the Medicaid expansion being weakened. It does tee this up for the November election and beyond, when in fact we'll have to have repeal and replace. Remember, even if we'd knock the entire law down, the onus would still have been on the Republicans to replace it with something that was better. And that was not, that's not a sure thing. It's not going to be a sure thing if the Republicans should prevail. It wouldn't have been a sure thing if the bill had been repealed. I mean, it had been completely invalidated. We'd still, they'd still face pressure to replace it with something. And that's where the next move is going to be. So, yes, this was really, really big. It did weaken the law and continue the imperative that it be repealed and replaced.
Thanks.
Go to our next caller. Professor Barnett, first of all, thank you for all your efforts in this litigation. It's not an an exaggeration to say that I think you saved the Constitution. Two questions here. First of all, could you address what I've seen emerging as a theme among some of the more liberal commentators, that the Commerce Clause holding was not really a holding, that it was dicta? And second, if the Supreme Court's not an option, how do you feel about Secretary of Health and Human Services?
Actually, I don't really care to work for the federal government. I've got a very nice job here at Georgetown. I'm happy to work with anybody there who wants to listen to me. Actually, just now you've got me so distracted I forgot
the question about the question about the Commerce Clause holding being dicta.
Yeah. Okay, this is really important that we mention this on this call because we're all going to be asked this question in the future. The dicta holding distinction is always a fine one. I don't think it's going to ultimately go very far for the left on this for two reasons. There's a technical way of looking at dicta and holding, and there's a pragmatic way of looking at dicta and holding. The technical way is, are there five votes? Were there five justices to sign on to an opinion which states that the holding of the court is what I just said it was, that Congress cannot compel activity in order to regulate it? It turns out there is, and I think this was done by Chief Justice Roberts deliberately, and I think it was acceded to by the liberal justices deliberately, and that is the liberal justices signed on to Part 3C of Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, and in that part of the opinion, he says, the court today, or I'm paraphrasing now, but the court today holds that Congress may not mandate activity in order to regulate it. Again, I'm paraphrasing it, but it's a one-sentence use of the word the court and use of the word holds. And it was in Part 3C of the opinion that was signed on to by four liberal justices. Therefore, there were five votes for that being the holding of the case. So if you look to what the court describes its own holding to be, there are five votes for that. The pragmatic side of the way of approaching the holding dictum distinction is to ask, are there five votes for the proposition that Commerce Clause is limited in the way Chief Justice Roberts said, and that the Necessary and Proper Clause is limited, and that the spending power is limited? Obviously, everybody knows there are five votes for that. The four conservative justices did not have to formally join the opinion to comprise five votes. So if you view this case technically, there are five votes for the holding. If you view it pragmatically, there are five votes. And I think it's actually the pragmatic consideration that dominates here, and that is that if you have a future, you know, let's say just Judge Sutton on the lower courts looking up and seeing, well, where is the direction of the Supreme Court headed, which is how he wrote his opinion in the Sixth Circuit, he's clearly going to see there are six votes for this, all of these propositions in the future. And to the extent lower courts are predicting what the Supreme Court will do, at this point we have five votes. Although I will add, since the word five votes is up, one of the things this case taught us is five votes are not enough. Five votes are not enough. As long as there's four implacable votes on the other side, you have to hold all five every time, and there's usually going to be something that causes some votes to split off. You know, because we had a drug case, because the Raich case was a drug case, we lost Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia. Because the Comstock case involved sexual predators coming out of federal prisons, we lost Alito and Kennedy. And Roberts. So, you know, you just – five votes are not enough. If you had six or seven votes, then you're going to find a much more stable conservative majority who are willing to uphold the Constitution.
Professor, thanks very much. Before we go to the next caller, Professor, I wonder if you want to respond to the assertion that's also being made that that the court never needed to reach the Commerce Clause part of the argument once they upheld on the tax grounds.
Well, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion specifically addresses that and rejects that proposition, and that's the part of the opinion that the liberals signed on to, by the way, Part 3, C. And in that opinion, he says that he only – remember, he does not uphold the mandate as a tax. He says that he has to – because the mandate is unconstitutional under the commerce power, and also, by the way, by inference, it's unconstitutional under the tax power too – he has to rewrite the statute to eliminate the mandatory nature of it, eliminate the requirement, treat the penalty as option, an option. You have an option to pay the penalty or not, as you or conform to the conduct that that the Congress wants you to do. And he says he's only justified in rewriting the law to mean something less than its natural and obvious meaning because of the constitutional problem. In other words, it's the problem of constitutional avoidance that he invokes in order to get to his saving construction, which is a rewriting of the Constitution. And unless he reaches the constitutional issue of the Commerce and Necessary and Proper Clause, there's no constitutional problem to avoid. So that's the core part of his reasoning. And I just don't think that that argument in the long run is going to work.
All right, let's go to the next caller.
Hello, this is Jim Lucas from TimelyRenewed.com. You mentioned in one of your earlier comments how we're going to fix this thing and the uncertainties of relying on the Supreme Court to do so. Obviously, there's another method to fix it, which you've worked on, which is the amendments to the Constitution. And you just had a piece in the New York Times, but I know that over the last several years, you've put out several iterations of federalism amendments that would hope to use the constitutional amendment to restore limited government. So I have two quick questions, which may be off base and maybe not short, but in that best of all possible worlds where Professor Barnett's federalism amendments were part of the Constitution, how would the Affordable Care Act in its many facets have fared? And second is this taxing power flanking maneuver yet another hole that those of us who dream of using amendment to restore limited government to the Constitution have to come up with a fix for, or is it just such a bad argument that we could rely on the Supreme Court to correct it?
Well, thanks for those questions. The quick answer to the last question is if you're going to take the amendment route now, which of course is somewhat premature politically because we have to have a bigger political momentum to get the amendments done in the first place, then I think yes, the answer to the second question is yes, we now have a tax power hole that probably was always there, frankly. And in fact, I think some of the Bill of Federalism I put forward tried to address that issue about when the spending power could be used, and it could only be used in service of the enumerated powers, let's say. Yes, that would be a hole you have to fix. Getting back to the first part of your argument, the Affordable Care Act would have been unconstitutional under these provisions that I've proposed, which would limit Congress's commerce power. I think it's important here to note something that this may be as good a time as any to remember this, and that is that look at what we couldn't challenge in this case. We couldn't challenge the insurance company regulations, even though insurance was not commerce under the original meaning of the word commerce. Why not? Why not? It's because of a 1944 case, Southeastern Underwriters, which held completely erroneously and very thin reasoning in an opinion by Justice Black that insurance is a form of commerce. That's what gives the federal government power over the insurance companies. That was wrong in 1944. It's wrong today, and there's possibly one vote of a justice that might be willing to reconsider that 1944 precedent. What we need is not. This case was all based on the Rehnquist Court principle that the New Deal represented the high water mark of constitutional power, and that if the Congress goes beyond that high water mark, it's going to have to justify what it does. It doesn't represent any rolling back of congressional power since the New Deal. And any kind of rolling back is only going to happen if there's a political will for that rollback. And that means you're going to witness it in Congress, you're going to witness it in the president, you're going to witness it in the body politics, like with the Tea Party movement, before you ever witness it on the courts. But the courts will follow along if that political movement gets going, and then I think it would be a good idea to lock it into the Constitution in the form of an amendment. I do flippantly say that the best, that my if I'm asked what my single most favorite constitutional amendment would be, it would be an amendment that said, it would basically be, I think, four words, and it would say, and we really mean it, oh, five words, and we really mean it. That would be the amendment. So that means basically give us all the Constitution we currently have, going back to the original question about the origination clause. Give us the whole Constitution. We're flying on, we're a four-engine jet that's had three engines shut down. We're flying on one engine. Let's light those other engines up and give us the rest of the Constitution. And most of the amendments I've proposed have just been ways of trying to get us back there by negating bad Supreme Court precedent.
Okay, we still got a number of questions. Let's move on to the next caller.
Yes, Professor, I have two questions. One is regarding the Commerce Clause holding. It seems to me that that holding, sort of its continuing vitality, as I think you recognize, depends upon the next justice appointed to the court. And if the liberal wing gets one more, it seems to me that none of the dissenters are going to feel any loyalty to this decision, and it could be easily overruled. I'm not sure that giving the decision itself on that issue much weight is worth anything beyond, kind of what our prospects are for the presidential election.
How would you feel if we'd lost this case on the law? Would you thought that was
I mean, it's better to win. It just seems to me that it's not some sort of precedent that's going to command respect by the opponents.
I hear you have two questions, so let me interrupt and just answer this question. Look, doctrine precedent is only as good as the justices who want to follow it, and so I agree with that. There's an awful lot of precedent I want to see not followed. So it's not like I'm a great respecter of precedent myself. But we did not make bad precedent. That was the most important thing. We did not make bad precedent that every justice, including some of our conservative friends, will then feel obligated to follow. And we happen to reaffirm the idea that we are a government of limited enumerated powers. Look, Lopez and Morrison were despised by the left when they were decided. And yet, Justice Ginsburg, in her opinion, in this case, cites Lopez favorably as providing a limitation on governmental power, because it's in her interest now, because of the political culture, to say, well, there must be a limit. Lopez is the limit, even though she was in the minority there, and she still doesn't like that case. So exactly how doctrine interfaces with the politics of the court is an interesting subject, but let me just tell you, if you litigate in the Supreme Court, you do not want to be going up against bad doctrine, because if you are, you are sunk. And I'll give as Exhibit A the Southeastern Underwriters case of 1944 meant we cannot challenge, we could not viably challenge the insurance company regulations, even though they violate the original meaning of the Constitution. So it's a victory. How much it matters in the future will depend on political developments. That was always going to be the case, but all things being equal, this was a big win.
Yeah, I don't disagree fundamentally with that. I only would suggest that there needs to be a whole lot of backfilling of support for the principles underlying the decision that would cause liberals to be reticent about overruling it.
Let me just say, I don't think liberals are going to be reticent about overruling any of the things we like. They haven't been in the past. If they were ever to get a five-vote majority, precedent is going to be by the boards the way it was during the Warren Court days and during the New Deal Court days. So that's not – the issue isn't getting liberals to adhere to it. The issue is establishing a precedent for conservative justices going forward to stick with, and to ensure that when future nominees are made to the Supreme Court, they are asked – they are vetted in private and in public as to which one of these opinions they adhere to. Do they adhere to the Chief Justice's opinion, or do they adhere to the conservative dissenter's opinion, or do they adhere to the liberal concurrence opinion? And that should be made a litmus test of future judicial nominees going forward. No more Justice Robertses. Either Owen Roberts of the 1937 switch or John Roberts of the 2012 switch. No more Justice Robertses should be our mantra.
Well, I agree with all of that. On the second question,
I got you to chuckle a little bit.
Yeah.
Something I got you to chuckle. Good.
No, I'm worried
do you have
that.
A sec, do you,
worried we're not going to of the politics. This is turned so much on politics. I agree with all of that, but it seems like perhaps there are things that can be done to try to strengthen the opinion to give it some life. But Rick, you know, I started off with the comment that, you know, I view that as a very dicey proposition. So that's,
well, maybe. Thank you very much. I think we should move on to another questioner.
Yeah.
But let me just suggest that, you know, look, the system we have, I want everybody to remember, the system we have, justices are nominated by an elected president and they're confirmed by an elected Senate. So our system is and has always been by design a political system for how we get our justices, and that's the reason why the Supreme Court tends to follow majority will with some lag throughout our history, and for better and largely for worse. We've generally had a majoritarian Supreme Court, you know, through the slavery period, through the Jim Crow period, and other periods. And that's because that's the way we get our justices, and that's the way our Constitution is written, and we have to realize that.
All right. Looks like we've got about a half dozen questions. Let's move on to the next caller.
Hi, Professor. This is Evan Bullock. And my question is, I saw in the opinion that Chief Justice Roberts stated that he believes the precedent that if there's any way to possibly uphold the law, then it's the court's job to do so. And I think that justified what I would consider the gymnastics that he used to justify this under the taxing powers. Now, is this something we should be worried about as far as going forward with Justice Roberts as the chief? Or is that reliance on that precedent something that you're not concerned about?
Well, I am, up to a point. I mean, it's not good. I mean, there is some doctrine that's like that. But let me just say, let me use this as an jumping off point to make a different point. And that is that in some respects, and Dean and I were talking about this before the call started, what we're experiencing now is the legacy of 30 or 35 years of the conservative legal movement's push for judicial conservatism. And by judicial conservatism, I equate judicial conservatism with judicial restraint, judicial minimalism, judicial deference, however you want to put it. This has been the mantra that many conservatives have argued for 35 years. This was actually the progressives' mantra against the pre-New Deal court, and conservatives inherited this from the more conservative members of the New Deal justices, who eventually took this line against the more activist justices. But this is what it got us. It got us a court in which we had we couldn't command five justices to strike down an act of Congress because one of them broke under this notion of deference. And in fact, the other four justices on our side were deferring to essentially precedent, which meant that they were limited to criticizing the unprecedented nature of the mandate and they wouldn't have entertained a challenge to the rest of the law as against the original meaning of the Constitution. So I think it's time for conservatives and libertarians to move on from judicial conservatisms towards what the Tea Party calls constitutional conservatism. And the difference is that judicial conservatism focuses on the role of judges and says, oh, judges should basically defer to the majoritarian branches. That was, again, the progressives' view. It didn't pre-exist the progressives. In favor of constitutional conservatism, in which all three branches of government are charged with following the whole Constitution, even the parts they don't like the origination clause that we talked about earlier. And that means that the courts, as a co-equal branch of government, have to pass upon the constitutionality of what the other branches decide is constitutional. All three branches have to agree that something's constitutional before they can go forward and rule the people. And why? That's because the Constitution itself, the written Constitution, is the ultimate sovereign act of the people. It is the law that governs those who govern the people, and therefore they should not be able to change the Constitution, and they should not be able to play a shell game in which the judiciary defers to the other branch's decision to expand their powers under the Constitution. So the bottom line here is I think we have to move off of this mantra of judicial conservatism and move forward with the mantra of constitutional conservatism. It's not a term I coined. It's a term I've picked up from actually the Tea Party and other popular constitutional movements on the right, and I think we need to start thinking about that again. And Chief Justice Roberts is nothing if not a creature of this judicial conservative idea.
All right, let's move to the next caller.
Hi, Professor. In the 11th Circuit, I believe they used some reasoning to strike down the law concerning, with the Commerce Clause by saying that there weren't any judicially administrable limits on the power of the government in the Commerce Clause, the way that the government was arguing.
Correct.
It.
Correct.
How is that reasoning been affected by this opinion? I read through it and I really didn't see anything that addressed that argument in the 11th Circuit.
I think Chief Justice Roberts just directly affirmed that A, the Commerce Clause is limited, and B, the power to mandate that people engage in economic activity in order for them to regulate it is beyond those limits. So I don't think he needed to use the slippery slope argument as much, simply by affirmatively declaring that this is beyond the limits. That is something that is harder for a lower court to do than it is for the Supreme Court to do. So I don't know that it was really necessary for him to stress that. But I don't think there's anything in that opinion that repudiated. I frankly don't know that he didn't say anything about it. I don't remember. But I do remember the most important thing he said, which was that the Commerce Clause has limits and that this is a power that's beyond those limits. And that refutes the liberal claim, which is held by 99% of law professors, that Congress has a national problems clause or that Congress has a plenary power to deal with anything pertaining to the national economy. Both of those positions have been held by law professors for 70 years. They were called into question by the Lopez and Morrison cases. After the Raich case, law professors went back to their default position, said, oh, we were right all along. There is a general power, and that's why they dismissed our case as frivolous, and now their position could not command 5 votes on the Supreme Court.
All right. We've got 4 more questions left at this point. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, Randy. It's Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice.
Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Randy, and again, thanks for your leading work here. I wanted to just reference your earlier remark about saying we can't make a justice do something they don't want to do, and that's certainly true, but I wonder if we can at least in the future make a justice stick to their original position and not waver under pressure. I mean, obviously we've got the legal part of it down pat. I mean, you and others did more than I think anyone legally predicted possible. What we didn't do, perhaps out of naivete or maybe it's just impossible, is win the I want to be loved by, the Washington Post war. And, I realize that's always going to be an uphill battle, but do you think there's anything we could have done, and I mean we very generally, just conservatives, lawyers or otherwise, to have done a better job in that war such that, Roberts may have stayed firm or will stay firm in the future, or some future Roberts, God forbid, will stay firm?
Well, look, I think there's a number of things. It's a very good question, Kurt, and I have a number of thoughts about it. First of all, when the left put their full court press on Roberts, and I, believe, although I have no knowledge of this, I don't want to claim I have any evidence or knowledge of this, but I do believe that that the president was tipped off on what was going on, which is, I said, after he started, when he had his outburst the Monday following the Friday conference vote, which to me was explicable only because he found out and therefore was so upset about it that he blurted out what he blurted, and then he had to correct it on Tuesday to make some sense. I think when the left put their full court press on the court, on the conservatives on the court, and in particular on Chief Justice Roberts, I don't think it was a complete accident that they did that. We pushed back very hard. I mean, I was in Israel at the time at a conference, and I was part of an effort to try to push back on the Jeff Rosen et al. Critique of Justice Roberts, and we got a very good pushback from the Wall Street Journal and from George Will, from Jen Rubin, from Kathleen Parker at the Washington Post, Ed Whalen, Mike McConnell. There was a huge pushback on this, trying to tell Justice Roberts that, look, there's a price to be paid for this on the right if he goes the other way. I think we did everything we could at that point to negate what looked like a pressure being put on him. And obviously, what this proves to us is that he, as an individual, is more afraid of them than he is afraid of us. Now, that may or may not have been a miscalculation on his part. I do think, for example, that Justice Scalia took an enormous amount of criticism and heat over the years for his vote in the Raich case by students and others who have asked him about that case ever since 2005. I think there came to be a point where he didn't even want to talk about it anymore. Now, the problem is I don't think Chief Justice Roberts runs in the same circles that Justice Scalia does, and he may not care as much. But I think it's important that we do not bail him out by arguing about what a genius he is and how he's the descendant of John Marshall, and that everybody's playing checkers and Chief Justice Roberts is playing chess. All of these things we've heard said about him. I just think that, first of all, it's just false empirically. I think this was actually a foolish move for him to make if he's concerned about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court.
Could be that Professor Barnett's phone has been disconnected. If you can all hold on, we'll try and reconnect with him momentarily. Randy, is that you?
Where was I?
Well, you were just saying that, you know, we need to make clear to Justice Roberts that we're not going to be forgiving.
Yes, and I think that that would also not, I mean, whether or not that has effect on him, because he's going to be, you know, Chief Justice for the rest of my life, it might have an effect on other justices who might do a different calculation the next time they have to make a decision. And look, I think what Chief Justice Roberts has shown us is that he's prepared to make decisions on the basis of considerations that are other than legal. And in the future, we sort of want those considerations to be moving in our direction.
And I guess we have to do our best to, you know, delegitimize the idea of doing things for the reputation of the court.
Absolutely.
So-called.
I really think that we should not pull our punches about this second switch in time. And how that actually undermines the proper function of the courts, as you've been emphasizing, Kurt, and it doesn't enhance them at all. And this should be – look, this, he could have done us a big favor. I mean, I'm not saying in this case, but in the long run, by delegitimating this way, this deferential approach and this idea that the legitimacy of the court is somehow overrides the Constitution in the minds of the general public. This was a case that the general public, not just in legal insiders, were focusing on. And they were outraged and disappointed by what happened here. And we need to make this part of the future going forward. This year, 2012, could be our 1936. There's no reason why 1937, which happened, which was the progressive constitutional revolution, is no reason why that can't happen the same way, only this time in our favor. It's what we've been working for all of our lives. And we have to realize that politically we could be standing on the threshold of another 1937, only one that works for us, because this case had such high-profile nature that everybody had an opinion about it, everybody saw what happened, everybody could see why it happened. We need to make sure the reporting is out there on that, and we need to make this an issue going forward, and it's very important that we not sugarcoat what Chief Justice Roberts did, even though what he did is he made a political deal in which he gave us a lot of stuff, and we don't need to give up what we got in order to criticize the way we got it.
And just to emphasize a point you made earlier, need to continue stressing that being a constitutionalist doesn't mean deferring to the majority branch where something is clearly unconstitutional.
Absolutely. We should be constitutional conservatives and not judicial conservatives.
All right, Professor Barnett, we've still got a handful of questions. We're going to try and get to as many of these as possible before we're out of time, so let's move on.
Professor Barnett, thank you. Let me add my thanks to those that have already been passed along. And wish that
I appreciate
you would consider
it.
Nation for the Supreme Court, should that ever happen. You have made the comment that if the law had been written as a tax, it probably wouldn't have made it to the Supreme Court, but I would like to observe that if it was written as a tax, it probably wouldn't have made it to the president's desk. Two questions.
Can I interrupt you for just a second before you get to your questions? And maybe you should limit yourself to one because we have kind of a queue going on. But let me just say, exactly. That's one of the reasons why a tax power, I think contrary to what John Rowland was suggesting earlier, is not as dangerous as the commerce power, and that is that people are politically attuned to the tax power, and in fact, the Democrats didn't have the votes to use the tax power for this, and in the future, that's going to still be a problem going forward. It's not that we didn't make bad law there. It's only that that bad law can be cabined by the political process perhaps easier than Commerce Clause regulations can be. Okay, now to your question.
When you made the observation that this penalty tax is not too onerous, and I'm wondering how many cases it's going to take in order to find the limit of onerous in that context. And
that's a good question. I've heard it before. It's bad that Chief Justice Roberts, you know, decided that a tax, the difference between a tax and a penalty is that a penalty is too punitive. At some point, an exaction becomes so punitive that it becomes a penalty. But that distinction was already in the law. There was already a distinction between tax and penalty in the law. This actually fits the definition of a penalty, not as a tax, as Justice Roberts admitted. But you're right. You know, drawing that line is not going to be easy. It's very similar to the coercion line that was drawn on the state side. And it took us 20 years before we got a case in which the court found that that line had been crossed. My point is that that's a principle that Chief Justice Roberts built into his decision. In the future, if justices want to limit the scope of this particular decision, that limitation's already built into what he said. And I do think we have to go beyond that and argue why a tax on inactivity should not be proper anyway, which is what I think is allowed here, or why it should be considered a direct tax and therefore need to be apportioned. But at any rate, I do think that you raise a good question, but the fact that he says it must be limited means that we can immediately argue that they can't have a punitive tax that's really designed to stop you from doing it. It's got to be a tax that's no greater than the cost of the alternative and needs to be less than the cost of the alternative. Otherwise, you are being coerced.
Terrific. A quick apology to the previous caller. We were getting some feedback on his line and had to mute him. But now, Randy, we're entering the lightning round, so I'm going to ask the callers to be as quick as possible with their questions. We'll try and get through these last few.
And I will try to be quick, too.
Hi, Professor Barnett. You wrote last year that federal medical malpractice limits were unconstitutional. You wrote it twice. And I wanted to ask about your view about the impact of this decision on Republican leaders' efforts to do that. They seem to be intent on enacting federal tort reform as the response to Obamacare.
Yeah, I mean, the jurisdictional basis for federal tort reform, believe it or not, is that state courts, state tort law has an effect on interstate commerce. Therefore, the Congress may regulate state tort law. I think that's a claim that goes beyond anything that we had in our case. I think it's easily challenged. I will help lead that challenge if it's ever enacted against that. And I think we'd actually have an easier time defeating that than we would have had defeating the mandate, precisely because it interferes with state functions.
Well, they've enacted it in the House. Why?
I know. And I don't know that they did enact it.
They passed it twice, once in the Paul Ryan budget, once connected to the IPAB repeal. So,
right, but what I'm saying is that I think that that's constitutionally suspect, and in fact, this court will strike that down.
I hope you'll put that in writing.
I've done it before. I'll do it again, and I'll do more than that. I'll be involved in a lawsuit.
Okay.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you.
Move to our next question.
Yes, Professor Barnett, I'm a little bit mystified by the capitation clause. That might mystify some other people. And I'm wondering how Justice Roberts gets around it. I don't quite see that. And is the capitation clause pretty much dead now as a result of this opinion?
Well, he gets around it in part because it's already been dead, or it's virtually been dead. He gets around it by saying that the only direct taxes that have ever been announced have been taxes on land or property, and since this is not a tax on land or property or whatever the limitations were that existed in the past, it was not a poll tax or a property tax. I think those are the two categories. Because it was neither of those things, therefore it can't be a direct tax. I think that's wrong, that's bad, but it's actually kind of old law. And in fact, we haven't seen the last time we saw any case that came out that way on the direct indirect tax was the income tax decision of the Supreme Court, which then gets reversed by a constitutional amendment. So it's never been a very strong constraint on federal power, and it still isn't.
Okay. Well,
although I want to say that we did argue vehemently that this was a direct tax and therefore needed to be apportioned and it wasn't, therefore it was unconstitutional, but he just blew past us by saying, oh, yeah, well, the only direct taxes are these, and then since this isn't one of those, it isn't a direct tax. There, end of story.
Take our final question now.
Yeah, hi, this is Glenn Bushell in Baltimore. I don't mean to suggest that me or anybody else could have done a better job, and I thank you all. You all thank you for all your efforts here. I think this opinion by the Chief Justice, though, is nonsense on stilts, and it's incoherent in many spots. But what my question for you, Professor, is we have an administration that seems to be systematically really ignoring the Constitution on a more or less irregular basis, whether it's not seeking the advice and consent of the Senate for making up positions or all of a sudden issuing exemptions to statutes that have been enacted and signed into law, whatever they may be, Defensive Marriage Act or changing the immigration law. I find the whole thing very troubling. I mean, the only oath of office in the Constitution is for the president, and this particular one, who claimed to say I do when the Chief Justice asked them, seems to be saying I don't really care. And in the broader sense, are the federal courts up to the task of reining any of this stuff in anymore? I mean, by the time they get the cases, they already have some age on them. And I just feel that we're being overwhelmed. As bad as the healthcare decision is in rending the fabric of the country, it's just like almost an everyday thing now. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on a broader sense on how this may portend for the future and other constitutional issues.
Well, I really agree with, as bleak as what you made it sound, I agree with everything you just said. And I think it's always been unrealistic to think that the courts are going to be capable of fighting an administration or an executive branch that is systematically deciding to take the course of action that this president has taken since the Democrats lost control of the House, which is what precipitated all of this action. Although, you know, obviously things weren't going so well before either. So the Supreme, because of the delay that you're talking about, and the fact that you have to tee up the right case, and there's got to be standing, and there's all, you're just not going to be able to get at all of this through the courts. This has got to be part of the basis of a political indictment against this this administration. That's the reason why November is so important. I hate to be apocalyptic about this, but I tend to be among those who think that I'm not sure our form of government as we know it can survive another 4 years of this. I'm hopeful that that the election is going to go the right way, and then at that point, if it does, the challenge is going to be to get Republicans, the very same Republicans who are promoting federal tort reform, as we mentioned a minute ago, to themselves do the right thing. And when you have one-party rule by Republicans, we've seen we've had problems in the past. So that's going to be a challenge too. But it won't be the same challenge as this one, and I think this one just has to be defeated politically or we're all going to be in trouble. And so I actually think that elections in this case are the single most important remedy for the problem that you identify.
Well, Professor Barnett, let me thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.